Although the subject of magnetism has been of interest to man for a very long time, comparatively little is known today as to the substance of magnetism. We are fairly well equipped now to analyze its processes and to create magnetic phenomena by artificial means. But the actual nature of the magnetic energy itself, like nearly all other basic energies of life, has not yet been solved or analyzed because of certain inevitable limitations of man's faculties and abilities to examine into things essentially not material or physical within the range of sensory perception. The existence of magnetism was known to ancient people. We find quite a discussion of it in Socrates, where he describes pieces of metal attaching themselves to each other to form chains. We know that the lodestone, a natural magnet, was given a great deal of thought by Thales of Miletus, later by Plato and Aristotle. And the area called Magnesia, where this lodestone abounded, has contributed at least part of the name by which we now know magnetism. In the early medieval period, considerable research was done, and so frightened were early navigators that certain mountains in distant areas were magnetic, that they caused their ships to be put together by wooden pegs rather than by nails, for fear that magnets might draw the nails out of the wood. Also, we know that at Thrace, priests and priestesses of the state religion healed the sick or treated disease by means of magnetic rods. These rods, long and slender, metallic tips, and possibly a core of metal running through them, probably gave rise to our popular concept of the magic wand, as it is found in the ceremonial arts of the Middle Ages, perpetuated in the conjuring arts of the modern world. The Chinese knew a good deal about magnetic theory. And as the lodestone was familiar to most peoples of the world, the Chinese also had their own particular type of magnetized substance, amber. Amber is not naturally magnetic, but if stroked or rubbed, develops magnetic properties. And today, the simple test used by the Chinese merchants when trying to determine genuine from false amber is merely to rub the amber on his sleeve or on a piece of cloth. If it then picks up small bits of paper, it is genuine amber. Thus, magnetism, representing an invisible drawing power, was recognized, and among ancient peoples it was customary to apply nearly all forms of knowledge to the human body in the effort to discover various treatments for those ailments from which mankind forever sickens. The development of magnetic therapy, however, was probably given its greatest advance by Paracelsus of Hohenheim, whose career extended into the early parts of the modern chronological period. Paracelsus used magnetized material for the creation of talismans, magnetic rings. He also used magnetic rods, much as the early Thracian priests. And he firmly believed that magnets and lodestones had therapeutic value. Of course, in all these early experiments, we are more or less on the horns of a dilemma. Certainly, these medications were used, and the reports about them were favorable. But considering the time and the circumstances, we are always left to wonder how much of the therapy was the result of the magnet and how much was a psychological cure, strengthened by great faith and further strengthened by the phenomenal power of the lodestone. In any event, people thought they got well, whereas in some of our modern methods of healing, people do not think that they get well. And the result is that they remain in their previous condition or become worse. As far as the application of magnetic theory beyond the use of magnetized or sanctified objects, beyond this, we come into several interesting areas of speculation. Actually, we know that objects of various kinds were blessed or subjected to magic rituals by ancient people. And that the same occurs in the early history of Christianity. Here, particular objects that had been sanctified in one way or another were held to have unusual healing power. I know cases quite recently in which rosaries carried by pilgrims to Rome and blessed by the Pope gained a considerable reputation for therapeutic value. As we mentioned in an earlier discussion, the touchstones and touch coins of the kings of Europe also developed long and illustrious accounts of remedial effects resulting from faith or from some quality actually bestowed upon the object. We have no method at the present time of clearly determining the possibility of causing objects to be impregnated with some kind of an electric effluvium or force. However, psychometry, which has gained considerable influence in our thinking, particularly in the last 50 years, would seem to indicate that certain energies from the human body are received and accepted by inanimate objects and held by those objects over perhaps an indefinite period of time. This seems to be the only explanation for a wide variety of phenomena that have been described and reported not only among civilized people, but among primitive people, who would scarcely have had the ingenuity to invent so complete an account, merely from some passing superficial analysis. Thus, we may assume for our moment, for this moment at least, that there is a possibility that some kind of a substance or essence is imparted to objects or belongings which may have some permanent effect. The dog, for example, apparently is able to follow the trail of a person by the peculiarly advanced sense of smell which the dog possesses. Yet it is almost beyond credibility that the dog is guided in the pursuit of a person over miles of territory simply by the sense of smell alone. It seems as though the animal must have certain other instincts by means of which it gains an awareness or is able to pick up some kind of emanation beyond that which is within the range of the sensory perception of human beings. Also, the peculiar habit that Thomas Edison noted of dogs howling on the occasion of death, which seemed to have some bearing upon this. The dog was not of the family of the person who passed on. Merely, the dog was in the locality or vicinity. And immediately, on the moment of death, the dog began to howl, although it might have been a mile or two away. This caused Edison to begin to suspect that there was some kind of a free energy in space which carried records of events and occurrences, or there were faculties in man capable of picking up various changes and modifications in the magnetic atmosphere. All of these possibilities center around the existence of some force, some radiation from a person which does have a lingering effect or continuous in the places where that person has been and among the objects that that person has once possessed. Primitive magic largely depends upon the magician securing some object which has belonged to the person to be involved in the magic or witchcraft. This possession forms a link. What kind of a link? The only possible link we can imagine is that some kind of energy is in this material, and that this energy is still associated with the person to whom that object once belonged, by what Paracelsus calls sympathy. This is the same type of thing that is recorded in the case of the amputated leg, which was buried and in a box in the cemetery. In nailing the lid on the box, a nail entered the amputated leg. The person who had lost the leg felt the pain of the nail for several months, although he was not near the place where the member had been buried. But when the nail was removed from the little box containing the removed member, the pain in the invisible leg of the patient ceased, thus seeming to indicate, again, some sympathetic connection between the individual and some part of his own body that had been removed surgically. All of this can only come to one general conclusion, namely that there is some kind of an invisible field of energy, of magnetism, as it was generally called, and that the person could use this energy in various ways to affect his life under certain conditions. Also, as Paracelsus pointed out, that the energy of one person could be communicated temporarily to another person in the form of a sort of invisible blood transfusion, a mysterious process of contributing energy. Energy is life. Energy is the basis of survival. And among the old Orthodox Jewish families of Europe, if some loved member of the family reached the gates of death, the other members gathered around the couch of the very ill person, and each one offered some part of his own life to extend the life of the loved one. There are mysterious reports of the fact that this sacrifice was wonderfully accepted, that the dying person recovered, but that the one who gave him this life had his own length of years correspondingly shortened. Such energy mysteries and legends and fables are too common to be completely ignored, yet frankly, the average person today does not know what to do with them, cannot put them together into any kind of an immediately rational pattern. Today, in our rather materialistic world, scientific men are loath to consider such problems as the medieval concepts of magnetism. As we continue, however, to explore primitive medicine, which has become quite a fad these days, and we continue to send expeditions to primitive people to learn their healing methods, it is quite possible that someday we will run across such a body of evidence supporting the idea of magnetic healing that we will be forced to recognize the need for a thorough investigation of the subject. In the meantime, we will try to put together some of the concepts that are now held by minority groups, individuals or small groups who have experimented with this field or have restored as far as they could ancient knowledge bearing upon the subject. If a magnetic element exists, it can be derived from a number of sources. First of all, magnetism may be a free energy in space itself. In other words, the universe has its own magnetic field. These magnetic fields are in certain relationship to the organized development of nature. If the magnetic force exists at all, and the lodestone would seem to leave no doubt, then this force is useful. This force does not exist primarily merely to stimulate the wonder and awe of man. Magnetism, if it is a natural phenomenon, is an essential part of natural order. It has some use, some very important reason for existence. And this reason for existence is not exhausted by the localizing of this magnetic energy in lodestone or its stimulation in magnetic iron. If this force or substance also has an existence in the world, in the earth, in the solar system, if the sun, as some have suspected, is directly related to the phenomena of magnetism. If the attraction of the moon for the tides of the earth is a magnetic phenomenon, if many of these forces and circumstances which can be observed are traceable to the existence of a magnetic agent, then we must assume beyond any reasonable doubt that magnetism is also a factor in the composition of man himself. Man must use this force, which belongs to nature, and from nature, this force must pass to man to maintain some part of human function in the same way that it must contribute to natural function. The second possible thought in relation to this matter lies in the relationship between magnetism and electricity. We know that the electrical agent also exists. We know that there is a basic difference between electricity and magnetism. Some have suspected that what we call electricity is negative magnetism. In other words, that while we have had the general tendency to think of electricity as a positive agent and magnetism as a negative, it may be the reverse. And we recognize electricity because it is more obvious, whereas magnetism is actually more closely associated with the life and survival factor in the world of which we are a part. Also, we can say that magnetism, if it exists in man, must exist also in other creatures. The Egyptians were certain that there was a powerful magnetic field around the cat. And both the Egyptians and the Hindus believed the serpent to be peculiarly associated with magnetic force. In fact, among ancient peoples, the serpent was frequently used as a symbol of the magnetic agent itself. If every living thing has a life of its own, it is also very possible that this life has a magnetic factor. The trees are therefore endowed with magnetic attributes, that even the elements themselves have magnetic factors involved in their compounds, that chemicals are magnetic to a degree, that in some things magnetism is obvious, in others not obvious. but that magnetism may be part of the entire cohesive principle by which matter is brought into the organization we call form. Paracelsus suspected strongly that form itself is a manifestation of magnetic processes, and that the failure of magnetism in holding together certain basic elements of structure results in the decomposition or disintegration of bodies. Magnetism may also be regarded as having a connection with the human will. It is quite possible that man is capable of directing magnetic energy by the power of his own mind. This would be especially true of such magnetic currents as might exist within his own body. The person may therefore be capable of causing energy to move from himself, to reach out towards some other thing, to influence that thing, or to condition it in various ways, or to impart its own life to other forms in nature. The ancients assumed that this was possible, but they used rods or some physical connection by means of which the magnetism of the operator could be communicated to the subject or patient. The question now remains as to whether such magnetic connection is necessary. In our way of thinking today, it is not, and we are inclined to suspect that magnetic current can be determined or directed entirely by the will or the mind, and that energy can be propelled from us or from our own natures into space by intensity of thought, concentration, or meditation. Such thinking, of course, has always existed to some degree among Oriental peoples. Another possible source of magnetism, of course, will be magnetized substances, elements in nature which are peculiarly associated with this element, with this phenomenon. One interesting thing that I think we should bear in mind is the effect of magnetism on the atmosphere and the atmosphere upon magnetic fields. This matter was explored some years ago in connection with earthquakes in Japan, where it was found that magnets were demagnetized a few seconds before an earthquake. This seemingly has other important suggestions for us. Shortly before an earthquake in South America, all the fish in streams and pools suddenly died. Just a matter of minutes, almost, before the earthquake, they began floating to the surface of the water dead. In another area, cattle that had been grazing in a certain locality suddenly broke into panic and fled the region. And within a very short time thereafter, the entire area of land which they had left broke off and fell into the sea. If they had remained there, they would all have died. As it was, no animal was on the area when it finally fell. Other examples will be the very notable effect of even small and minor earthquake shocks upon the hatching of eggs. An earthquake tremor so slight that it would not physically move anything, except perhaps slight agitation, will immediately kill eggs in an incubator. Yet, if you take hold of the corner of the incubator and shake it much more violently, it will not injure the eggs at all. There is something communicated directly by the magnetic force of the earthquake. Now, various opinions have been advanced as to the cause of such possible magnetic association with earthquakes. One has been that the magnetism is generated as a result of the land motion. In other words, an earthquake occurring over a fault, the motion slowly begins underground with tremendous resistance, and that this very slow but powerful resistance motion may create magnetism, as in the case of the Chinese rubbing the amber on his sleeve. This might be a fairly good answer if we were sure that the earthquake in question arose from this source, but we are not at all certain of that. We are not at all certain that the origin of an earthquake is actually within the ground itself. We are beginning to suspect now that the earthquake itself is a magnetic atmospheric phenomenon. and that there is a discharge of static electricity, a discharge which, striking a fault, causes motion. This could well be true if, as in some instances, we find very strong evidence of magnetic effect or influence at a time when the most delicate instruments that we possess today show no indication whatever of any earth motion. It was originally held that the motion produced the magnetism. But the magnetic reports of more recent years show that the magnetic disturbance precedes any possible record which we can make of motion of any part of the earth itself. This we also observe in another way in connection with many earthquake reports. And some of you probably have been through some earthquakes and will perhaps be able to bear witness to this. That shortly before an earthquake, most persons suffer from a slight nervous shock or agitation, very often striking the pit of the stomach. The individual feels a moment of nausea or feels a very definite sense of personal disturbance. He feels as though something is happening that he doesn't know about. It worries him. It becomes a definite sense of illness without any actual sickness necessarily following. And a few seconds after this rather peculiar nervous tension, the earthquake may be felt. But the research on earthquakes has already proved conclusively that there is a magnetic factor, and that this magnetic factor almost inevitably precedes the shock. Sometimes by only a few seconds, sometimes by several minutes. This, because we are able to classify it to some degree, and to notice its effect, for example, on the hatching of eggs and things of that nature, must cause us to realize that there is an energy or a substance moving in the atmosphere, which can have a direct and immediate effect upon life itself, as in the case of the eggs, or can cause concern, agitation, and panic among animals that certainly will not react to any ordinary psychological stress such as man knows. But these warnings or these magnetic disturbances affect temperament, affect the individual. We often hear the term earthquake weather, a peculiar stillness, a peculiar suspension of energy. We are beginning to take more interest in this type of problem since the development of the atomic bomb and the various developments therefrom, because we are now experiencing the possibility that disturbances of the atmosphere enveloping the planet may very directly affect all life on the planet and can, if sufficiently pronounced, endanger the life of creatures inhabiting a planet. In some way, therefore, the invisible world around us begins to move in upon us. And while we cannot see it, or we cannot entirely estimate it, we have some recognition of its value or of its importance. Human beings, like all other creatures in nature, also have certain eccentric manifestations with which we associate them. There may be 1,000 persons attend a conservatory of music. Perhaps a half dozen of these will become leading musicians. The others will become at best only satisfactory, and some will never be able to develop any advanced musical appreciation or technique. The same is true in sciences and arts. And nature is continually producing exceptional individuals in various fields of activity. The history of the healing arts from the most remote times indicates that this is true, and that there have been persons at various times in history who seemingly have possessed extraordinary healing powers of their own. these individuals are capable of causing the sick to be improved by proximity to the healer, or by methods of the transference of some invisible or certainly intangible effluvium, which seemingly has the same effect as an advanced medication. The use of electrotherapy, the use of electricity and magnetic factors in the diagnosing of disease, such examples have already become reasonably familiar. We know today that we are able to gain a far greater knowledge of the more subtle elements of diagnosis through the use of electrical equipment. All of these steps of progress bring us closer and closer to the core of our subject. And this core seems to indicate that there is the possibility of the development of a therapy, of a method of healing, resulting from a growing and improving knowledge of the magnetic fields or energy fields of the human body. If we go back to the beginning of the theory of medicine, well, we come upon a very simple, basic concept. Namely, that it was the intention of nature that man should be well. That the human being, like all creatures in nature, is supposed to have a reasonable span of health. This span of health is presumed to extend from the beginning of life to such a period as the functions of the body, exhausted by natural fatigue and age, will simply cease to continue to function. Nature, however, did not intend individuals to be invalided throughout their lives, to suffer from innumerable aches and pains, and to be half dead long before the appointed time for their departure. This continuous record of illness, infirmity, disease, and some, to some degree, even accident, all of this together implies some ignorance, some misunderstanding, some disobedience in man, by means of which his natural allotment of health is impaired or actually destroyed. Nature's processes for keeping things healthy is to impose upon them an adequate system of circulation and ventilation. Nature is so balanced that if its processes are permitted to develop and function normally, that nature is continuously healing itself. The world will heal itself of any and all natural ailments that may develop within it. It has the mysterious power of restoring. It has the power of purifying its own atmosphere, of purifying its own water, and of gradually replenishing its own soil. The earth, if not abused, and its natural processes unbalanced by some interference, will move along in a comparatively healthful manner, maintaining the life upon it in a reasonable state of well-being. It is largely, therefore, man's unbalancing of the laws governing natural processes, man thrusting upon nature too rapidly, an excess of problems for which nature cannot provide immediate solution. And the same thing happens within the individual. Nature intended this body to be a self-remedying structure within a reasonable degree of function. It expected that the body would recuperate from its own depletion, that it would restore and repair such common damage as might naturally come to it. And it is only when man's way of life or the circumstances of his living confront him with an excess of danger that the recuperative power of nature is inadequate. So the purpose of nature's construction in the beginning was that all things should have the remedy for their ills within themselves. And what we know as therapy in general arose from man's artificial attitude toward life and the fact that through neglect or through ignorance or excess, the individual passed beyond the condition in which his own structure could remedy its defects. Nearly always this condition is reached through intemperance or through the breaking of the common rules of health which nature has given us to understand by way of the intuitive and instinctual faculties of our own consciousness. Those false or exaggerated conditions which cause man to become ill and which prevent nature from being able to meet the challenge of the energies needed to recovery, these are for the most part depletion and obstruction. Depletion is the exhaustion of resource, and obstruction is some circumstance arising which prevents the natural flow of energy through the body. The moment the flow of energy to a part of the body is restricted, particularly by some serious obstruction, the area not permitted to enjoy proper circulation begins to decline, and in the case of the human body, infection sets in, and if the condition is not remedied, the individual will die. Obstructions, wherever they occur, challenge means to remove obstruction. Depletion, wherever it exists, challenges us to find methods of replenishment. Actually, sickness is not nearly as physical as we have been inclined to think that it is. Nearly all sickness arises from the failure of energies to maintain the normal function of structures and organizations in the body. Thus, the restoration of energy, the redirecting of it, and if necessary, the temporary exhilaration of it, so that it may break through some block or obstacle. Such processes would constitute a normal approach to therapy. Up to the present time, however, we have not assumed that these energies could be directly communicated. Thus, we make use of various secondary means. Nutrition, particularly under the vitamin mineral theory, is intended to assist us to get the use of nutritional factors more rapidly for the increase of energy, for the maintenance of vitality. And this has developed largely due to the adulteration of the foods which normally should provide energy. And there is still a moot question as to whether artificial energy through medication can be regarded as an adequate substitute for natural nutrition. We know that food grown on exhausted soil, soil impoverished of minerals, and probably impoverished of energy, cannot supply to us that energy which it does not possess. Through the adulteration and over-refinement of food, we also find a diminishing of vital nutritional content, sometimes practically the total loss thereof. So that while the food may apparently nourish the body, it fails to sustain the magnetic fields, which are important to the total function of man. Now, Paracelsus was of the opinion that the primary function of minerals in the body is to hold and direct magnetism. Therefore, that what we take into the body in the form of minute amounts of mineral and metal, these form the magnets, by means of which energy is drawn from free space and is held Therefore, the depletion of certain poles in the human body makes it difficult for man to hold on to or attract energy. The old parallel of the radio is again as good, perhaps, as we can use. The radio program is somewhere in free air. The individual has a radio set to be used for the reception of this program. What happens? If this radio set is inadequate, out of order, or out of attunement, the radio reception is imperfect and inadequate. As a result, the program, though it exists in space, just as neat and perfect as ever, simply cannot be recorded in the inadequate or broken instrument. In the same way, although the energy necessary to nutrition is everywhere, it cannot be held unless the instrument to receive it is capable of tuning it in and capable of holding and distributing it. We have long held that most nutrition originates finally in solar energy, and that therefore what we call vitality is conditioned sun energy. We are now suspicious, however, that the problem is a little larger, that not only the sun, but many other parts of space and many other rays and energy fields affect man, pouring in upon him in a variety of ways, so that he is actually swimming continuously in a sea of complex energy. Man, however, does not need to worry about drowning in this ocean any more than the individual with a proper radio set need to fear that 100 programs will deluge him at once. He has the proper means of tuning in what he needs. Those forms of energy which he cannot consciously use may still serve him through the unconscious functions of certain parts of his body. Other energies not for him and not suitable to his kind of life, but necessary to some other form of life, simply make no record in his nature, but go on to fulfill their original purposes. Thus man, by creating polarities within his own nature, is constantly attracting to himself that energy which he needs for life. If he is unable to so attract this energy, then he is depleted, devitalized, or unable to function. Devitalization through exhaustion, depletion, also has a tendency to cause obstruction. Obstruction may simply result from the gradual loss of activity in an area. When this activity is reduced below a certain level, it gradually results in the setting in of a crystallized state. And in this crystallized state, obstruction in the form of crystallization begins to prevent the proper flow of such energy as is available. By degrees, therefore, the body becomes crystallized. It no longer serves as the immediate channel for energy. It no longer distributes energy properly through nervous and arterial venous circulation. It no longer is sustained adequately by the energy which can reach it, or the struggle of the function is not equal to the opposition of circumstances. And gradually the body sickens. Thus, the therapy, as Paracelsus pointed it out, in your field of energy, lies in reaching behind the physical situation as it exists, and to discover means whereby the available energies can be brought into direct relationship with those structures which need them for survival. Paracelsus also held a series of other thoughts, one or two of which I think might be timely at this moment. The first is, we have always held the attitude that in magnetic healing, the energy from the healer moving to the patient resulted gradually in a depletion of energy in the healer. This has been observed, and I think there is no question but that the constant association with the sick has proved to be exhausting, not only to the magnetic healer, but to the physician in general. The sick, in other words, have a tendency to vampirize the well, to live upon such energies as they can find, not necessarily by any intention to do so, but for the reason that sickness becomes a negative situation, a low-pressure area into which energy flows. This can also occur through very long and close association between the young and the aged. The older person struggling for survival may unconsciously or unintentionally draw energy from the young, in whom this energy appears to be superabundant, and it would appear that such as they lose might never even be missed. But the tendency to borrow energy, to take it on from whatever source it can be gathered from, has also been generally observed. The magnetic healer of the 18th century and even earlier tried to direct energy by means of the mind. He used his own will as a method or an instrument to impel energy. He came to the conclusion that by determination or by visualization, he could cause the energy in his own body to move from that body into some area or location in the body of the patient. Thus he would will his own energy to turn and become a curative agent in the structure of someone else. He might add to this willing the definite action of attempting to create a polarization with the patient, as in the religious form of healing by the laying on of hands, or by some direct contact, such as placing his hand a very short distance over the affected area of the patient's body and visualizing the motion of energy from his own body into that of the patient. There has been enough evidence to indicate that man can direct and control the flow of energy within his own body. He can cause it to become intensified in a hand or a foot. He can cause it to intensify the functions of a sensory perception. In other words, he can stimulate the power of hearing temporarily. He can stimulate the power of sight temporarily beyond its normal function by the intense application of mental effort. He can also cause energy to move throughout the body to break down various obstructions, to reduce swelling, or to restore nerve function that has been lost by some accident or illness. Thus, by the power of mind over matter, by the exact and definite energy of the mind, the individual is able to force energy to break through various barriers and reestablish a degree of circulation or normal function. This would lead then to the possibility of this emanation actually extending from man. And we have this in the researches of Rickenbach and many others. Photographs have been made of the natural flow of energy from the extremities of the human body. The magnetic field of the human body, brought under a great deal of exaggeration through high-frequency electrical means, has been photographed, and it has been shown that the human body channels electricity and static energy along certain definite structure. If therefore, for example, you should throw a great deal of high voltage into the human body, which will not injure it and will not cause any discomfort, and then under the power of this voltage itself, you photograph it, you will discover that its motion from the surface of the body particularly follows very closely the extremities. That, for example, this energy is particularly abundant, streaming from the ends of the fingers or from the palm of the hand. But it will not be so abundant streaming from some part of the torso or trunk of the body. The energy has a tendency, therefore, to move along the circulation system and to escape from the body in the hands or feet, or sometimes in the head. Also, in normal conditions, without this exaggeration, it has been possible to photograph the haze of energy which does surround the body in what has commonly been called an aura or a halo, as in the case of the Kilner screens, which have made this magnetic field comparatively visible. It would then naturally also follow from experimentation with plants and with human beings that this energy can jump a small distance without any apparent difficulty at all. And if a person places his hand 2 or 3 inches from the body of another person, the energy from the hand can definitely move into the body of that person, unless it meets some magnetic resistance to prevent this from occurring. Also, it has been noted by magnetists working with the sick that various ailments arising in the body of man create their own magnetic fields. Therefore, a very sensitive magnetist, with eyes closed, running his hand over an area of the body, say 1 to 2 inches from the surface of the skin, can feel as he approaches an area in which an infection or some form of obstruction exists. He suddenly experiences one of two things, either a sudden increase of warmth or a sudden increase of coldness. It is sufficient for him to immediately sense, although he has not touched the area. Apparently, the coldness is most likely to be present where function has been obstructed, or a process of disintegration has set in. The sense of heat, where there is swelling or congestion. And this is perhaps a little more remarkable inasmuch as the area involved may be well within the structure of the body, several inches from the surface. Yet the magnetist can still immediately feel it. Dr. Kilner of Liverpool pointed out also that by means of the magnetic field shown by his screens, it was perfectly possible and entirely practical to diagnose the early stages of pregnancy. He was able to discover pregnancy far before any other test known was able to distinguish it, simply because of the immediate change in the direction of magnetic currents in the body. But this entire field of body magnetism should therefore be neglected is perhaps a serious loss to those who are still struggling to attain health under the pressures and problems of our time. Magnetism, however, we also realize, has other values or factors involved, and that regardless of all other equations, magnetism is affected by the mind, by the emotions, can be controlled by them, or can be very seriously injured by them. It is very possible, therefore, that what we call the magnetic field is essentially the link between the psyche and the body and the source of a very large amount of psychosomatic phenomena. There must be a bridge by which mind and matter are brought together. There must be a reason why the moods of the mind will affect the chemistry of the body. We know that the effect exists. We are not sure, however, of the bridges by means of which this effect is produced. It is all right to refer to the fact that our thoughts affect our bodies, but how? Certainly these thoughts do not sufficiently and immediately disturb function explain the situations that arise. Researches with Kilner screens and with other elaborate electrical devices, including the polygraph used in criminal investigations, all these have proven conclusively that there is a psychic sympathy between mental, emotional function and body function, and that this psychic sympathy has a series of obvious poles of relationship and other poles that are not obvious. One of the most obvious, for example, is respiration. Another very obvious pole is the effect of mental and psychic stress upon the sweat glands. And another interesting and important link is the effect of mental and emotional intensity upon the cardiac rhythm, the action of the heart. It is, we know now, perfectly possible for a person to die of a broken heart, and that a sufficient amount of psychic intensity will damage the heart structure. But how does this occur? We cannot assume that within the structure of physiology as we know it today, that we have a rational explanation of why certain emotional attitudes should ultimately result in bodily toxicity. We must assume, therefore, that as the body is maintained by energy, and that this energy is variously differentiated, we must assume that in some way our attitudes affect the availability of energy, and that psychosomatically the various attitudes of man are associated with their symbolical equivalents in the body, that therefore the thoughts of man are certainly associated with the brain. The emotions of man are certainly associated with the heart system. Various attitudes, hate, fear, greed, all of these differentiated emotional mental processes affect various degrees and qualities of energy. Each one of them interferes with the function of some conditioned energy, or causes to arise a corruption within energy itself. This corruption, like the pollution of a water supply, in turn will poison the physical structure depending upon this corrupted energy for its own survival. Thus, mental-emotional attitudes unbalance the energy supply of structure. And this energy supply is so differentiated psychosomatically that each emotion or each attitude will result in damage to a sympathetic correspondent structure in the body. That it is not just simply a bad attitude making the whole body sick. It is a certain kind of a bad attitude affecting the nutritional energy of a certain part of the body to which it is symbolically or psychically associated by sympathy or similarity. This goes back to your old Pythagorean theory, but it has never been disproved, although it has been ignored for a long time. It would then appear possible to assume that energy responsive to the psychic attitudes of the person can also be exhilarated, can be made better, that energy can be supported by the psyche. Well, the psyche itself is also a kind of energy. And it is one kind of energy working upon another kind. And in through this entire operation of various levels of energy, there appears to be the continual and progressive structure of a law of octaves. In other words, as in music, as in elements, we have octaves of sympathetic patterns. We have harmonic and enharmonic intervals in music. In the same